Hello, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus, the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. My name's Kyle Anderson. Thank you for joining us again. I am joined by returning champion. You know her. You've probably read her books. She is good and great and is the editor-in-chief of Nerdist. It's Amy Radcliffe. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Kyle. That was a very kind introduction. If you could just clip that recording out for me. Sure. And anytime I go anywhere, like the grocery store even, I'm just going to play that verse.
Like, did you not know that she is good and great?
Excuse me. I'm good and great. Thank you.
Those are, yes. But so this week, we are talking about something that actually happened last month. But because we were doing all of our end of year lists and stuff like that, we didn't get around to actually talking about it. And that, of course, is the 20th anniversary of Return of the King, the film, the Peter Jackson film, which itself was the culmination, of course, of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And Amy and I were sort of trying to figure out like what to talk about this week. And that seemed like a really a good one for both of us, because we both really love Lord of the Rings, and both I'm going to speak for you as though I know, but I do know that we both really, really love that trilogy of films. And yeah, so we're just going to have like a little like reminisce sesh and kind of also talk about like how the trilogy in the 20 years since has kind of begat other, you know, big budget, you know, quote unquote, like prestige fantasy and sci-fi and stuff like that. Because I mean, the fact that those, especially Return of the King, won so many Oscars, it's sort of unprecedented in terms of fantasy filmmaking and everything like that. So yeah, let me ask you first, did you, when the movies were coming out, had you already read Lord of the Rings, the books, or was that, like me, your gateway into the books?
That was my gateway into the books.
Yeah.
Yeah, after seeing them, I think I started... probably started the books after The Two Towers came out in theaters. Mm-hmm. And then I think held on to Return of the King until after that came out, because spoilers for this decades old story. And I'm glad I kind of did it that way, because one, I didn't bring any of that like baggage into it, right? About like, well, how does adaptation does not have X, Y, Z? Like, which I generally try not to do anyway, because adaptations are their own things. But I'm glad I watched those films first. And like, it's kind of delightful even now when I reread those books or revisit The Hobbit. Like, those are the actors from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and the gentleman who plays Ian Holmes, right? Bilbo?
Yeah, Ian Holm, yeah.
That's who I picture, like, always. And like, it just makes me happy that, you know, forever and ever, like, Sean Bean is my Boromir, and what's his name is my Faramir. That classic
David Wenham.
Wenham. I get him just name mixed up with David Thewlis.
Sure. Right? Who is Lupin in the
Lupin, right? They don't
in the trilogy
even,
of movies written by a TERF.
Very yeah, that lady.
Yeah.
Very slightly alike, but I get them mixed up for anyway. Yeah. So yeah, I came to the books after.
Yes. Yeah, I was sort of like as with many things in my formative years, goes back to my grandpa. My grandpa is a big sci-fi fantasy dork. You would never think it. He was like he's since passed away, but he wore cowboy hats and boots all the time, and like, you know, shirts with snaps on them, was a union electrician for his entire career. Like a real like blue collar salt of the earth guy, but he absolutely loved sci-fi and fantasy stuff, and read the Lord of the Rings books. He was the one that I would go see the Star Wars special editions with when those came out in 97. And then we went to go see, you know, Star Trek First Contact together. I vividly remember these. And then he went, I had already seen it once with my mom, but then he and I went to go see Phantom Menace, and then we watched, you know, the other Star Wars prequels and stuff like that. So that was our thing, like going to see these things. And when Lord of the Rings was first coming out, I had heard of it. Like, there was bits of it that I had kind of glommed onto from just diffusion of pop culture. But then going to see that first, The Fellowship, and going, you know, when they do the prologue, which is maybe one of the best things in the entire trilogy, is so good. But then going, oh, this is The Hobbit. Like, because I watched the Rankin and Bass Hobbit cartoon when I was
sure.
a kid. And so I was like, oh, they're talking about Gollum and Bilbo and all this stuff. I was like, I didn't know that was this. I didn't know anything about it. And then like just being like, oh, I already kind of know what this is. That was a really great thing. And then like, so he and I, and then sometimes my mom would come with us and we would just go see these movies. And that was a yearly, you know, because they came out December, like every year for 3 years. And so that was just like a thing we went to go do. And it's wild to think that that was 20 years ago, but also like, it also feels like much longer ago. Cause it just sort of feels like these movies have just always been a part of me, in a really strange, way that I can't really quite quantify, but like, because I didn't grow up with the books and it was, you know, 2001, 2, and 3, I was already in high school and out of high school.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know why it feels like I was so young then, but I don't know. That's just how it feels on the inside, is that I was like young and full of awe. And I think that's just kind of like the wonder of those movies, is like inspiring that level of awe in people.
That's the effect they have. And I mean, when you are that age, like, you, I mean, now I think back that I can say like decades ago, plural, I'm like, no, I was young, like I was a baby.
Yeah.
But it's more that like, similar to you, and I hadn't even seen, you know, the Hobbit, the animated one. I just knew nothing other than vague, like, I know that there was a guy named J.R. Tolkien, and he wrote a lot of fantasy stuff. And then, because I had read, you know, The Wheel of Time and whatever was out of A Song of Ice and Fire at that point, and things that were very clearly like, I'm like, oh, that was inspired by. But it's weird to think of a time in my life that for so many, you know, for the first whatever number of years, because math's hard, 20-ish years, like, that I didn't know what Lord of the Rings was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's wild to think about. So like you, I feel like 20 years, because it feels like I've known those my whole life. So it feels, you know, even though it has not been, it's been half of my life.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. Time.
Anyway, time. And the wheel of it. That's interesting to hear that you read, because I didn't even know what Wheel of Time was until the show came out. So like, that just completely missed me. And I remember hearing people talking about like at that point, like only two or three of the Song of Ice and Fire books had come out. But it was still after Lord of the Rings and everything like that. So it's interesting for me that you came at it the other way. Like, that was sort of like the Rosetta Stone of like, oh, that's where they're getting all of this. Cause it's very clear from both of those series that they're heavily inspired. How could you not be? Like, he's the Ur-text of what, you know, I want to say high fantasy, but like, yeah, like that is kind of what it is. Like, he took mythology and from different parts of the world and was specifically filtering it through I think this might be apocryphal slightly, but like, Tolkien was a linguist. Like, that's, he wanted to just figure out, I want to make new languages and have a reason to put them somewhere. But then also was sort of like lamented the fact that after the Battle of Hastings in 1066, that and the Norman invasion, like, there was no English mythology anymore. It was all just kind of filtered through the French. So like, because even like Camelot has a lot of French influences on it and everything like that. Anyway, all of that is to say is like, what if there was a mythos that is specifically English? And it's funny that they shot them all in New Zealand, because you could not get further geographically away from England, and yet it feels so like of a piece. Like, New Zealand just seems like it is Middle Earth at this point. And I think most people kind of go there for that purpose, to like visit Middle Earth.
Yeah. I went to, you know, I went to Wellington once for a set visit, and there's not a lot of specific, like, I mean, Weta's there obviously, but there's not like a lot of specific filming locations. But there are a couple, and there was a gentleman who basically did tours based on, and like, I got, or he got in touch with me because we knew each other on the internet, and he's like, okay, how long do you have? And it was like a said visit trip, right? So I had like a day free, and like we knocked all these ones out. Anyway, a long way to say, like, when I go back to New Zealand, which I will make happen, I want to go. I really, really, really want to go to Hobbiton very badly. Yeah. And then I will explore the gorgeous country that is New Zealand from there. But that's what will get me to buy the plane ticket one day.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I have a friend who went for her some birthday. Like, she's a huge Lord of the Rings fan, and just went by herself and like joined a tour group and stuff like that, and went and had such a great time in Hobbiton and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's so weird to me to think that I already mentioned briefly Harry Potter, but like in my head, that's like, I know people have like that level of passion for those books as well, but those were younger than me. Like, I read a few of them, I watched the movies, but I wasn't like, so when people are like, that's their whole thing, that's their fandom, is that seems so strange to me, because that's like new. And like,
yeah, I get
they're
that.
Talking about growing up with it and everything like that. Whereas like, people who are Lord of the Rings fans, I'm like, I get it. There's a joke about you in Friends episodes.
Like, there is.
Yeah, they talk about Gandalf the Party Wizard was a guy they knew in college.
I love that.
Or in high school or something like that. And then, so the joke is, they're talking about Gandalf the Party Wizard, and Joey doesn't understand it. This is Ross and Chandler talking about it. And they're like, you didn't read Lord of the Rings in high school? And he goes, no, I had sex in high school.
Oh, that is such a good 90s joke.
It's such a 90s joke.
Wait, anyway. Friends was the 90s, right?
It sure was.
Okay, I'm like,
it went into the early, into the mid 2000s, but it was 96, I think, that started. Anyway, long time ago. But yeah, so let's kind of just talk about the movies in general. And so you said you watched the first two and then started reading the books.
Yeah, if memory serves, which does not always. And it still even took me like years beyond that, I feel like, to read The Hobbit, even though I mm-hmm. read Lord of the Rings. The first time I read them, I struggled a bit with the songs, and still do a little. But now I know, I'm like, okay, I've read them once, I can skim them. And I'm glad I waited to read Return of the King until after that movie, because a bit of that book, like the... there are a lot of Frodo and Sam bits that go on for mm-hmm. a while. And the Two Towers a tiny bit too. And it was nice to read them and then come back, like, because I revisit them and I'm like, well, I'm just going to read my favorite bits now. And yeah. That's okay. But it still took me a while to get to The Hobbit, and then a little bit after that to get to The Silmarillion. And I still have stuff on my shelf. Like, I have The Unfinished Tales.
Yeah.
Like Beren and Lúthien, like the newer stuff that I just haven't read, but they look really nice on my bookshelf.
Mm-hmm, they sure do. They're really pretty books. Yeah, I was sort of the same. I did a dumb thing, which was right before the third movie came out, I hadn't read any of the books yet, and I was like, well, I want to start, but I was like, I want to just read the Return of the King. So I started with Return of the King, which makes no sense, because there's bits of the Two Towers book or film that is from the beginning of The Return of the King. So the movies one-to-one do not correspond directly right. with the books. And so I was very confused at first. Also, the books, less so the first one, obviously, because everyone's kind of all together. But like, as the different branches go off of the different, you know, the fellowship breaks up, you have, especially in the third book, you have all of the Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli stuff first, and then they go back in time and do all of the Frodo and Sam stuff to the end. So like,
that's
section
right. That's
one,
why I struggle with
it. Yeah, exactly. And I think that like, obviously that's the text and that's what they're doing, but like, very smartly, Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens knew, we need to make it paced better for a film. And so that's when they did the cross cutting. And so I, as somebody who hadn't read any of the books yet, reading just the third one, starting with the third one, and they don't do that, I was very like, what? Like, I was so confused. Like, wait, when are they, I thought the Battle of Pelennor Field was happening right now, but they're just getting to Mordor. Like, I was just like, this doesn't make any
sense.
What
is going on?
Yeah. Also, I think the first section of that, the Fellowship section, ends with what seems like Pippin dying. And that's the cliffhanger. And then it goes to a completely new section. Right. And I'm like, did he die or what? Like, it was like losing my mind. So,
that's hilarious.
I was dumb. I shouldn't have done that. And yet that's what I did.
Did you continue with that? Or did you like realize the error of your ways, or like you're, that you'd made a mistake and like, all right, no, I'm just going to stop. And then I will go back to the beginning. And
no, I read that entire book.
The tone of your voice, you're like, no, I did that.
I did do it. And I don't, I'm a very like, it's part of my like anal retentive OCD thing where like, I can't do anything out of order. So even though I started out of order, I had to continue that way.
You're like, I'm committed.
I've committed. I'm pot committed all the time. But then of course going back, and then I read The Hobbit in like a day, like I just like an afternoon. Like, it's a very short book. And it's a very light book, but man, I just tore through that one. I love it. So, and I've read that one, that I've read The Hobbit a bunch of times just because it's very fun and quick.
It's very
and easy
cozy.
And everything like that. But I will say I have not read it since The Hobbit films, because that ruined what I think is an otherwise amazing story. Those movies are very bad, which we're not here to talk about, but they're very
no,
bad.
No, but I will say I only watched the...
Oh, that's right.
I watched the first two, but I only watched the third one. I think it was earlier this year, because I just was not impressed with the first two.
You
but
mean
I'm
in
like,
the last 9 days?
I'm just like, oh, Ray. I'm like, it's 2024.
Sorry. I'm being a d-hole.
You are. Last year, Kyle, finally watched the last film and realized I could have not.
No.
And now
it's
I know
the
that.
Worst one by a lot.
It
it's
is
so
rough.
Stupid.
But then the good part of it was like, you know what I'm going to do to wash that taste out of my mouth is a reread The Hobbit. And it had been a little while, so it was delightful.
What I was really hoping... Nah, I don't want to talk about it. The Hobbit movies are a whole thing, and there's very good like video essays out there about like what happened and why they don't work or whatever. But so much of the disappointment of those movies came from because we were all like, oh my gosh, the Lord of the Rings movies are so perfect almost. Like, but anyway, I think the entire point I was trying to make initially about how reading and all this stuff is once you'd seen the movies and then went back and read Fellowship, were you surprised? Because of the three of them, I think Fellowship is the one that they changed the most, because they, you know, they put in all that stuff with Arwen being like a warrior elf and all that stuff, which she's not in the books or anything like that. Were you surprised going back and reading the books how different that first book was?
I was, but in a good way overall, because obviously there, you know, there's not as many detours. There's not Tom Bombadil, and that is fun on the page, but yes, with the tone they were doing on the screen,
right,
it would have been, well, would have felt like moments in The Hobbit that didn't feel you know, great or weren't entertaining on the screen. So it was a little jarring to see how different it was, but at the same time, like, throughout kind of what you already said, the way they adapted, like, that's just one of the beautiful things of those movies is the adaptation choices they made, and that were so precise and thoughtful to be true to the world, be true to Tolkien, I feel like, be true to the characters, while, you know, maintaining a certain pace, like a narrative that will actually keep audiences engaged and not like, they've been singing for a long time, or they've been meandering over here, and ultimately it does not super impact the story. It's just a nice little jaunt. And any moments that were, I can't think of a concrete example where you have those kind of jaunts that don't really impact the story a lot, but maybe it like has a character, an impact on a character. Like, I just felt like it was carried out in other ways, that they didn't sacrifice anything that was like, oh, I can't believe they left that out, or I can't believe they changed that. And it was positive to see, which they did do with The Hobbit too. Tolkien's world is very male. Just coincidentally this morning, a newsletter I read had The Morning Brew, highly recommend, had just a link to an article that was like a scholarly breakdown of the demographics of Tolkien's Middle Earth. And it was what you expect. Like, this is not like anything revelatory. Like, we all know, like, so it was important, like, you know, to see. I really liked seeing Arwen's character change a little to be more, kind of more of the, like, the savior in a way, or more of the, like, I can get this stuff done and I'm not just sitting here pining after this mortal man I've fallen in love with.
Right.
Anyway, all that to say, yes, I noticed the changes, but there was nothing I really, like, disagreed with about the adaptation. And I feel like that's, no, I don't know if that's common or uncommon, but.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like most people are, those movies are so beloved. I think that that's like one of the rare occasions where even the staunchest, like, book first person about any adaptation. I know people who, if they've read the book and see the adaptation, are immediately like, well, that's not what's in the book. And it's like, yes, of course, but that's also not how things work. But I think most people, all the changes were for the betterment of the film, and for the pacing, and like the fact that all three of those movies are really long. And yet, with the exception of, like, the joke is like the 17 endings of the Return of the King. They all, like, they're all paced so well that you don't even mind that much. And like, they figure out where to put the, you know, like the high points and stuff. And they, you know, and splitting the books up the way they did into the three different movies, you have stuff like, you know, Boromir's death and like the Fangorn Forest battle happens at the beginning of the Two Towers book. But in order for there, because otherwise it would just kind of end, you know, there's no climax to that book.
Right. We need a
punch. Yeah. And so, like, you have Boromir's death and like the splitting up of the Fellowship, and that works really well thematically. And then the same thing with the second movie, or I guess the third movie, like the Shelob fight actually happens in the end of the Two Towers book. So there's actually a bunch of stuff from the Two Towers book that they stole
rearranged for the other
two movies, but
which I appreciate. I'm glad they looked at it as a whole, like, to determine the flow of the three films instead of being,
because
really
otherwise
rigid.
Frodo and Sam have very little to do in the third book. It's just walking, like, they're just right at the end of the journey and stuff like that. And, you know, they encounter the orc camps and stuff like that, but like, there's no reason for that not to be in the beginning of the movie. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I do think that they kind of pulled back on, like, because in Fellowship, Arwen is, you know, if you want him, come and claim him, like, literally an action person. Is that what people are called?
Yes, action elf.
An action elf. And then they kind of were like, you know, she's a strong enough character the way that we're writing her that she doesn't have to be.
Like, because that's a
pitfall that I think a lot of screenwriters and people who are writing film and television fall into, which is that so what's a strong woman? Well, they must be physically strong, or like that, and that's not the way people necessarily
are. What if they
have
a cool weapon and some, like, leather, right, probably?
And they did a really great job with Eowyn in that way, and Eowyn's like one of my favorite characters in the entire trilogy, because she knows what she wants, is going to go get it. And that's like, somebody might go, that's so lame. She dresses up as, you know, in a soldier and goes out and fights. And it's like, well, no, that's in Tolkien. So that's not actually, that wasn't changed for the movie. But they pull, you know, like, I think initially when they had initially filmed the Battle of Helm's Deep, which they shot for like months of night shooting. Like, I can't believe it.
Ugh.
But Arwen, like, initially was there. Like, she showed up with the cadre of elves and, like, helped. And, like, they were like, you know what? It doesn't actually – there's no thematic reason for her to be, like, here, other than we just haven't seen her in a while.
Yeah, and we're just like, let's shoehorn her in.
And I'm glad that they changed it. Like, so there's stuff like that I think they were learning as they were going, even though they were filming that for 2 years or however long they filmed all three movies, like, at once.
Which is still a bananas. Like, that's another part of these films too, right? It's not just the finished product and that they're a really smart, beautifully done adaptation. Like, I feel like the making of them has become just as much of a part of the mythology of those films in a way, like from like the behind the scenes things to like as soon as you said the thing about the, you know, how Return of the King has multiple endings. All I think about is like a story I've seen repeated, or I've heard Sean Astin tell repeatedly about how they were doing the scene. They're saying goodbye as Gandalf and Frodo go to the Undying Lands. And like, it's a continuity thing. Like, they filmed it all. They're like wrecked. And somebody's like, you didn't, your vest wasn't on. Like, we have to do it again. And they're like, oh, why? All those little bits and like, and yeah, they filmed it all at once and they got their tattoos and the incredible like making of, like, still to this day out of it's kind of embarrassing to say this, like, those are the only behind the scenes features I have watched every second of on the home release, because just the making of those films was such a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment, like, on all fronts.
Those are some of the best home releases of all time. Like, when you're thinking about when they actually put care into putting extra features on the release of big new movies. Obviously there was the initial, like, you know, first salvo, but then when they put out the extended editions,
all those that really, case too,
that look like books on their shelf. Yes. Like, it's so great. But yeah, like, the making ofs were very, very long. And then they had huge documentaries about the actual text, like scholars talking about the actual books themselves. And I found those so fascinating. And like, you know, and that's like why I got excited for the Silmarillion, is like, they talked a lot about that stuff within the confine or in the context of talking about the filming and the original Lord of the Rings book. And it's like, they talked about Beren and Luthien. It's like, I want to know that shit.
Like, yeah, like, I need to read that.
What age is this? You know, like, all that stuff.
Watching all the bigatures be made. Like, yeah. I mean, that was some of my, you know, I was, again, an adult, but kind of like, and like, I remember the first point I became like, of being aware of, like, oh yeah, like, people make all that stuff you see in movies, and like, thinking about how that comes to be. And it was incredible. And I wish every movie was still made exactly like that, which is not correct. But those bigatures were just like, that which just blew my mind.
Yeah. I mean, Weta, like, across the board, like, just did amazing work. And there's a reason why they are still, like, they're the only company, I think, ever to rival Industrial Light and Magic in terms of, like, renown, I guess, like, because, you know, there's like K&B effects and stuff, but they do more like horror gore stuff, and, you know, but like, when you see Weta Workshop's name on something, you're like, oh, this is gonna be good, you know, like, because the quality of their work is so high always. And you know, there's documentaries about the Weta Workshop the way that there was about Industrial Light and Magic, like, growing up and just feeling like, oh my god, that's, what is that magical mystery place that you need to go to?
Right. And Richard Taylor does kind of have that vibe when I hear him talk, of like listening to like a Phil Tippett or like a Dennis Buren.
Yeah, he really does, doesn't he?
I'm like, yeah. What else? The music too, by the way. It's been a minute, but I used to listen to, I go in phases. I will listen to things nonstop, and then I'll switch and listen to a different thing, and then I'll go back to something else. But Howard Shore's music for all of those films. I was trying to remember if Return of the King like had a standout one for me, like the theme of Rohan, which name I used to know the tracks by name, the ones I liked a lot. In Two Towers was a real standout for me. And I know there's something in Return of the King, but I can't. Oh, I don't remember.
Well, there's like, Return of the King had a song, like an actual song, like that Annie Lennox song.
The Into the West.
Yeah. Which is a great song. But like, that, again, it was like, they swept the Oscars. There was not one thing that they were nominated for that they didn't win. So like, that I think was just another example of that. But yeah, Howard Shore's score for those things. And I completely agree. Like, Two Towers is my favorite of the films. It's also my favorite of the books. And it's almost entirely because of Rohan. I love that, the look of it. I like the Celtic meets kind of Scandinavian, like, just vibe they have. I like horses, you know, the fact that they're the horse lords and whatnot. And then the Battle of Helm's Deep is just so
incredible.
Great.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, I know it's technically larger in scale and everything like that, the Battle of Pelennor Fields. I don't like it as much. Like, I like
the Battle of Helm's Deep better. And something about the Helm's Deep battle, like, it feels more desperate. Like, there's, like, a battle.
Yeah.
Like, there's more of a concern. Like, I don't actually know if we're going to we're going to make it. Like, I do know we are, but I don't know if we will.
Yeah. Look to the east, you know, like, all that stuff. And, like, when it comes over the ridge and you just see Gandalf the White and then, like, the riders who have been banished earlier in the movie and all this stuff, it's like, oh, it's so good.
Oh, man. And there was this, still not Return of the King, but there was a trailer, I feel like, for the Two Towers that had, it featured the Battle of Helm's Deep prominently and music. I think it was, was that piece of music called Requiem for a Dream? And it had to have been a trailer because I don't think it would have been like fan videos, like, were not as much of a thing that I was watching circa that era. Anyway, that just is, whenever I hear that music, that is what I think of. I think of whatever video or trailer I saw that, like, is like the rain coming across Theoden's face. And anyway, Two Towers. Yeah. Excellent.
Truly excellent. I want to, like, I mean, obviously there's a million things to talk about. Let's go back to Fellowship for a second. One of the things that I really like is that they take their time in Hobbiton. Like, we spend a lot of time in the Shire before anybody leaves, which is true to the book again, but, like,
that surprised me about the book and still does.
How much time,
like, how long it lapsed between, like, I'm just giving you this ring. And Frodo's like, cool, I'll just wait forever to do anything with it.
But months go by before he comes back with the information. Yeah. It's wild. I think, I mean, and that's very true to, like traversing land on foot and even on a horse, like, it's going to take a while. So it's very true to that, but it's very funny that they're just like, you know, before the adventure even begins. And then the Tom Bombadil part, it's like, you've literally just left and now you're already having a detour with this weird man of the forest and stuff.
It really didn't take long. And it's kind of like, it fits, right? Because it's not like they're super adventure focused. They're not really like, yeah, let's go out and do this. They're like, well, Frodo's like, I guess I got to take care of this because Gandalf says so. Yeah. And the rest of them are like, well, I guess we'll go with you. So let's just drag our feet and go as slowly as possible. And maybe the problem will go away on its own. Gandalf will just take care of it. And we can just go back home and have some pints of ale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, like, it was a genius move on a lot of fronts, to be true to Tolkien in that way, to, like, it is by and large the Hobbit story, because you can have, it would be very easy to make it Aragorn's movie story. You know what I mean? Or Gandalf or any of these other people who are leads of the story, but are not the leads. Frodo needs to be the main character and the four hobbits need to be central to all the storylines in some fashion. So, that was very nice. And it's interesting. Did you ever see the Ralph Bakshi semi-animated one that does, it does most of Fellowship and Two Towers in one film?
I just watched The Hobbit. It wasn't that one. No, I have not seen that.
It's a weird one. Ralph Bakshi's an interesting guy, but, like, he does a lot of, rotoscoping. That was his big thing. So he was like, he'd film people, like actual people, and then take the film and animate cells like over it. So it looks really strange. And there's, especially the Battle of Helm's Deep, where there's just like, he took like other movie battle footage and just like drew on top of it and stuff. Like, it's very weird.
Wild.
But there are some shots from Fellowship, especially, that literally are directly out of the Ralph Bakshi movie, which I'm not sure. Maybe I just never heard, but I'm not sure Peter Jackson has ever like acknowledged, but when they're in the forest, the four of them and the ringwraiths are there, and there's the shot of the four of them like back up against a log, and the Nazgul kind of like looks over. That's a shot directly from that animated movie, which is very strange because I only saw that much later.
And you're like, hey, wait a second.
It's like, hey, because that's such an iconic shot from that movie. I was kind of annoyed that, like, because the ringwraiths are so cool in that first movie, and they don't really do, I mean, then they show up kind of sporadically throughout the next two, but I was just like, man, I want more of them because they're really scary and weird.
Yeah, like on Weathertop, that whole bit is,
yeah.
I mean, that whole chase is terrifying, but that scene in particular, like, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they get run over by water horses, and that's a weird bit.
Yeah. And like, you know, when they ride the big, huge serpent dragon-y things, I know they have names. I don't care. I do care, but I just don't want to think about it.
But also, like, that gets the point across.
Yeah. The serpent dragon-y things. Oh, crud. What was I just about to say? Do you have some, what are some of your favorite bits, scenes in Fellowship?
In Fellowship. Okay. I was curious to ask you, there was one I was prepared for Return of the King, and then I was doubting myself and being like, maybe that was Two Towers. But in Fellowship,
we'll get there.
Fellowship is when they get to Rivendell for the first time.
Yep.
And right around the time those movies came out was around the first time I started playing Dungeons and Dragons. And talk about a world that is very heavily influenced by Tolkien's like mythology. So that very like going to Rivendell and seeing the beauty and meeting Elrond and Arwen, and I'm like very cemented. I'm like, well, I will play an elf in almost every Dungeons and Dragons campaign for life now. I stick to a thing when I like it. Plus elves have cool abilities. But that was just kind of such a moment of like awe at the beauty of knowing that, you know, this is a combination later of learning like of models, right? And art. And I can't remember if matte paintings were used in these movies. I kind of don't think so.
I'm sure there's some matte paintings.
But
yeah,
it kind of gave me that same years later when I went to Yosemite for the first time. This is going to sound silly to say, but when you drive into Yosemite, you drive into the valley and you see it, like there's this beautiful, like you come out of a tunnel and like there you are. And it's just like, it's just an awe-inspiring moment that never gets old. But that first time is just like, wow. And I was like, oh, this is how I felt when I first saw Rivendell. So yeah, that's my favorite. What about you?
That's definitely a good one. I really like, when I was reading, the Lord of the Rings or the Return of the King, was on a camping trip that my family went on. I grew up in Colorado and there's a lot of opportunities to camp in the mountains and whatnot. And wherever we were camping, the way that the mountainside looked and the trees and everything like that reminded me so much of Fangorn Forest that just became like my de facto favorite scene from that movie, because it's so reminded me of Colorado. Like, just the kind of hills and there's paths and roads and stuff like that, but it's so kind of secluded and quiet, and it's just sitting there reading the Lord of the Rings in what was effectively a location from it. Like, it was really cool. So I love that battle, and I like setting up that, you know, for the whole thing, you have Boromir sort of starting to like fall, you know, like get wooed by the ring and all this stuff. And then like for him to like legitimately save himself, or, you know, not save himself, but save Frodo at the sacrifice of himself, was just like a really beautiful moment for that character. The only downside of that whole thing is that Sean Bean's not in the rest of the movies.
I know.
Because he is really great. God, now that I'm thinking about it, there's so many good Fellowship moments.
The
council scene is great. One does not simply walk into Mordor. Like, that has been a meme for 20 years.
I feel like I tell someone at work, like one of you, like you have my axe, like, or my sword.
Oh yeah, we
like,
say that to each other all the time. Yeah, yeah.
Like I'm pretty regularly. Yeah.
Like the encounter with Galadriel in the forest is rad.
That's right. That's fellowship too.
That's so much as the fellowship actually. The friggin' the fight, the wizard fight between Gandalf and Saruman is in that movie.
That's yeah, that's really cool too. I'm like, no, it's not. And I'm like, yeah, no, it is.
It is. Yeah, you wouldn't think so, and yet it is. And then of course the Mines of Moria, which is legitimately like maybe the best part of that movie. It's hard to say. That movie's yeah, actually
really good.
Like superb. It has the most stuff in it.
I cannot believe that's all in Fellowship.
I know. And the, you know, the friggin' the Balrog and everything. Shall not pass. That's another meme. I mean, man. I got to rewatch these movies. It's been a while. It's been too long.
It's funny. Someone had just messaged me over the weekend. A guy I met at Celebration who him and his wife right after Star Wars Celebration in London were going off to Oxford to look at Tolkien things. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I need to do that. So now we just message each other about Cats and Lord of the Rings. And no relation between them except that we both love both of those things. And he was just saying him and his wife, there was a I know the movies came back to theaters, but I was unaware that apparently the extended editions were back too. And they had done, I don't know if it was like a marathon all in one sitting, which I could not do.
I've still never been able to do that. I know people do it, but I've never been able to do it.
But it did make me think, I'm like, well, I haven't seen the extended editions on the big screen and I haven't seen those movies on the big screen at all in a while. And ultimately I was like, I don't know that I want to go to a Cinemark and do that if it's still available, but I do need to watch them at home soon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's been I will say it was the Hobbit movies. They like soured me on it. And so I hadn't revisited, if not for the Amazon show, which is imperfect. We can both agree that it's not the best version of Tolkien that we've ever seen, but it's also not directly adapting any one thing. So I think they're just playing in the world. Yes. But that got me more excited
for
that universe again, to revisit it. Yeah. I still haven't done it, but now I want to. Now I'm definitely going to after we're talking about it. So Two Towers, we both said is our favorite. What are some of your, let's take Helm's Deep out of it, because that is the best part of that
I'm
movie.
Like, yeah, that part.
I think something, and a part that we can both agree, I think led to so much more in just filmmaking in general is Gollum and Andy Serkis's performance, because that is.
Oh, hell yeah.
He played a bunch of different, like we wouldn't have mocap performance capture. That at the time it was still motion capture. Now it's performance capture because it's a performance.
Right. Between like Ahmed Best and then Andy Serkis, like those two things, like right at the same time. It just like made that technology just like leap forward. But
yeah.
Gollum, oh my gosh.
And that second movie is basically Gollum's movie. Like you have the Fellowship doing all the stuff with Rohan and that's excellent, but like meeting Gollum and him like trying to insinuate himself into Frodo's life and Sam hating him immediately and stuff like that, which is not in the book. Sam doesn't care about Gollum. Sam doesn't actually have much of his own.
Does Sam care about a lot in the books other than
Frodo? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But all that stuff worked so well and just like, you know, talking about food, like obviously a lot of those books are about food as well, but like Gollum and Sam arguing about how best to make fish.
And it's just, Gollum getting grossed out by the idea of potatoes.
Yeah. And cooking things like, ew, what are you doing?
Why should you do that? And that scene, when Frodo and Sam are sleeping and Gollum is having a conversation with himself and is really torn. Even still, like whatever the last time as I watched it, like that holds up and you're like, this is played and written and performed everything so well that you can really feel that like divisive, his divisive self. And it builds up that like, yeah, he's not just, it's not black and white, right? He is this kind of pitiable, if that's a word, creature.
Mm-hmm. And we know that we literally know that there's multifacets to him. And like the first few times he changes like Jekyll and Hyde, like talking to himself.
Yeah.
It's in one, like you see the character do it. And then they literally cut it. It's a
conversation.
Like it's a conversation. It's so good. That whole sequence is outstanding. And it's a crime, honestly, that, Andy Serkis doesn't have like three Oscars for his performance capture work, because he is always amazing in everything he does, and he has to do it through CGI.
Right. And he conveys all of that.
Yeah.
This is not on the same like level of that, but a moment that I'm always like, yeah, that's so cool, when they kind of break Grima Wormtongue's hold over Theoden and he transforms back to himself. Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
Theoden is one of my favorite characters, weirdly enough. Bernard Hill does such a, like, I just think that is a great character, and it's like he comes in and kind of starts owning, you know, he's a king. Like, he's not the king of men, but he is a king. And so he, when he like regains himself, like he has to worry about his subjects and all that stuff. And I like, it's a legitimately tragic moment in the third one when he gets killed in battle, because like he's a devoted uncle. Like, Eowyn is not his daughter, and yet he's like, she may as well be,
because
that's how much he like cares for her and everything. I think that performance, that's a standout for me just as a character. And I love that moment. Yeah. Cause you see it, like they break his hold, and then it like, it very quickly fades or like transitions to Saruman. And you see that he's been like, because that's literally
thrown him yet. And his, oh, the lighting of the fires, like, oh, that's so good too.
Gondor calls for aid.
That's, oh my gosh. That's in the third one. That's right. Oh yeah. Because Gandalf has to,
Gondor has to call for
aid. They have to be. Yeah.
Yeah. What is there anything else in the two? I mean, there's a lot in the 2 hours, but is there anything else in the 2 towers that would preclude us from moving on to Return of the King? That we haven't mentioned yet.
I don't think so.
There's the warg writing and the fact that people thought Strider / Aragorn was dead for a while. Yeah,
that's a part that I actually is not like that I'm okay with.
Yeah.
Is it Treebeard with Merry and Pippin? In the 2 towers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's all fun. I think the Ents, like, they did a really good job with that design and the way they move and.
Yeah.
Merry and Pippin together, always a hoot.
Well, that was another, like, you know, again, not having any context with the books or anything like that. They just seemed like annoying characters to me initially in the first movie. And so I was just like, oh, they're still around. And then by the time you get to that movie and they convince Treebeard or like trick him sort of to see how terrible the forge is at Isengard, it's like, oh, this is. They're very smart, actually, in their own little hobbity way.
Yeah. Well, still, like, doing goofy things. Like, let's just knock these bones over into a well.
Fool of a Took. I love Treebeard's a great character. And I like all that. You know, I think one of the downfalls of the trilogy, and they've acknowledged it, just because there's so much that they had to try to get into 3 movies, and even the extended versions can't do all that stuff. But I do think, because it's Christopher Lee and it's such a great performance and he's so good in the first movie and the second movie, that the fact that in the theatrical cut, he's just not in the third movie is really a bummer. I'm glad they gave him a death scene in the extended cut, but like, we know as readers of the book that there's this whole, you know, scouring of the Shire sequence at the end of the book, where Saruman returns and tries to get like, no, I'm still going to do this. And then they have to like, and that would have just taken the piss out of the whole
thing. The whole, but I feel like that was the thing Christopher Lee kind of talked about being like,
yeah,
bummed about too, right?
Yeah. But his death scene, I mean, it's a good death scene in the extended cut.
Yes.
Where he gets flung off the thing, the ramparts of one of the towers.
That's right.
Orthanc and Barad-dûr. I love those
dude,
old
dude. Nice.
those elfish words are so fun to say. Yeah, Return of the King. It's a long one. It's a long movie. Even longer than the other two. It's like 200 some minutes, which is really long.
Dang. Which I think now that I'm like, yes. Whereas any current movie that's long, I'm like, no. Why would you do
get out of
that?
Here. What are you doing?
I
really wish I didn't have the reaction about movies, but I do. I'm like,
I do
why
too.
Is it so long?
If it's over 2 hours, I'm just like, but why?
I know. I'm embarrassed
mostly
to admit,
they don't need
but,
to be.
Yeah.
Like often because you're like, well, that I could have lived without at least 30 yeah. minutes of that movie. But
I mean, I think for whatever reason, more so now, movies are just, and maybe it's, I mean, there have been long movies forever, but like, what movie is it? Is it Intolerance? One of the like old D.W. Griffith movies or something like that is like 8 hours long. Is it that one?
That is ridiculous.
Long movie.
Who let that happen is what I want to know.
Don't give me minutes. Get out of here. Well, there's the 1994 Bellatar movie, Satan Tango, which is 7 hours long. But I feel like I'm thinking of a different. It doesn't matter. But anyway.
Yeah. If when it's a mini series, fine. But that's like folks who make like limited TV series being like, it's a 6 hour movie. And I'm like, TV shows are not movies. Please stop.
Yeah. I don't know how anybody can actually get away with that. But
yes.
And yet they do.
And yet, except the Lord of the Rings trilogy, in which I only ever watched if I'm going to rewatch it as extended edition all the way. Like I need that to be as long as possible.
Yeah. The most I have ever watched is like, do you remember when the Blu-rays or I guess the DVDs too, but like because the extended editions were so long, they had to split the movie in two discs.
Yes.
I would watch Fellowship and the first half of Two Towers one day. And then the next day I would watch the rest of Two Towers.
Oh,
and then, That's the closest I ever came to watching it all in one sitting. You know, when you get to like 6 hours of watching one story, I'm very bad at binging. I think we've talked about that on this podcast before, but like I have such a hard time watching more than a few episodes of something at a time because it's just like, I want to do something else.
Man, it depends what it is, but I'm good at it.
Man, I know a lot of people are. I wish I were because I would get through things a lot faster, but I can only watch a few and then I get burned out and need to do something else. Even if I just watch a dumb YouTube video after that, like I just need to have something else going
on. Yeah.
Yeah. There's just, you know, there's a savoring aspect of it too. But like if it's something like this that I've already seen a few times, you'd think I'd just be able to put it on and not pay attention,
just
but I
go.
Can't do that.
Yeah, no, it's never, I think I've done that a couple times. I'm like, oh, Lord of the Rings, good background, cozy watch. And I'm like, well, I'm just watching this.
And now I'm just watching it, yeah.
And that's what I'm doing.
I was trying to put on stuff, sometimes I'll just put on like long play, let's play videos of people playing video games.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes with commentary, sometimes just the game. And so over this last weekend, I was putting together furniture, which as we all know from anybody who's bought IKEA furniture, takes a while.
And always even longer then, than you think of. Well,
always,
that's for sure.
Always longer. And even then I stopped and had to like, and I was just like, found myself just watching. It's like, what am I doing? Just build the stupid things and then watch it or whatever. But anyway, I remember like acknowledging in the theater that that Return of the King was a long movie, but not caring or not being like, God, this should be over, because I was just like, it felt like you had gone on a journey with all these people and you didn't really want to say goodbye to them yet.
You're like, I need to be here until the end, but I don't want it to end.
Yeah. And you know, and that is the joke. Like if people are not on board with what they've been watching, I can see people being like, oh my God, they're still saying goodbye, or they're saying goodbye again, or like, when is the, you know, like, but like, as the fellowship breaks apart, like, that's, you're sad. Like, oh, now we're never going to see Aragorn and Arwen again. Like, you know, there's that element of it. Like, you know, my friends, you bow to no one. Like,
oh, come on.
If you're not crying at that point, I don't want to know you. That's not true. Some people don't cry at things. I get it. But that's such a moving moment, and everybody kind of kneeling down to the hobbits and them just kind of standing there because they don't know what else to do.
Like, to, like, us, for us?
Little old us.
Return of the King. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Nope. Go for it.
Return of the King is where Faramir rides out on his own with a very small force, right, out of Minas Tirith. To like that scene, talk about a scene that makes me cry buckets every time, because it's while Pippin is singing too, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Denethor's got his red juicy tomatoes, and boy, that scene, yeah, even thinking about it, I'm like, that one's a heartbreaker. And yeah. So beautifully filmed, like the overhead,
yeah, and then just like them just getting absolutely annihilated, like,
right?
It's not even a fight, honestly. Like,
no,
it's,
this is like we're riding to our death.
Yeah,
and Denethor just being Denethor a real is, Denethor about it.
Oh, he sure is. John Noble's performance as Denethor is so good because I hate him so much immediately.
For so long after that, would not watch anything with him in it because I could not disassociate him from being this awful, awful character.
And then you watch Fringe and you're like,
I did start watching Fringe like 2 years ago, and I'm like, oh, he's just sweet.
He's delightful.
But it did take that long. I'm like, I'm going to hold Denethor against you for decades.
I get certain weird lines in my head. And if I really think about it, there are ones from all of these movies that I will just say, you know, like even just to myself in the way that they're said, because that's why they get in my head. It's not the line necessarily itself. It's the way that the actor says it. But for whatever reason, one of mine is, bring me wood and oil, which is what he says when he wants to burn Faramir's body.
That is a random one.
I know, but it's just like, he just said it so like, like I John Noble's voice is amazing.
Yes.
But I don't know why that's the line that always comes to me.
That's ridiculous, and I think it's great.
Really, if I really spent a second, I could go through and be like, there's got to be some other ones. But I won't sit here and think on the podcast. But I wanted to like. Gondor felt less real to me than Rohan did. And I'm not sure why that is, or if that is a function of the film or the way that they constructed it or whatever, because it's not like the quality of the production goes down or anything.
Right.
But for whatever reason, like, I never liked Gondor's aesthetic, I guess, honestly. Like,
I was
always just
that.
Like, ugh, those dumb humans, like... I don't know
why. Minas Tirith is beautiful. But
it's very like,
it is, I'm like, you're going up this road to do the thing, and you're just on the same path, and you're going up and up. And that just seems like poor city planning to me.
Yeah. And it's not warm. It feels very cold. I think that's the main thing. And Rohan and, you know, Edoras especially, like, feel so
cozy.
And there's nothing cozy about Minas Tirith. It's white marble. Like, it's like, it's and Denethor's chamber is so big,
and then it's, you know, on the border of this land where they just, you know, they fight orcs. Like, that's just their life.
This
so
is
it's
their
not
life. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very austere.
What a good word. Cause that's really exactly what it is.
Yeah. Beautiful bigature though.
Yeah, it really is. Well, just the amount of, I love miniatures and bigatures, but like, I love all that stuff. I like looking at really elaborate model railways and stuff like that. I just think that's so, I like that aesthetic, right? Or it's not even an aesthetic. I'm not even sure what you would want to call it, but I find it very soothing for some reason to look at very tiny things that are really intricate. I don't know why. But watching that whole thing and in the making of, and just seeing like people next to these cities that are enormous, but still obviously much smaller than what an actual city would be. Like there is something so awe-inspiring about that level of craftspeople-ship.
Yeah.
That I feel like we are definitely losing a lot in films nowadays, because, you know, that movie used CGI to enhance its tactile things. And I feel like more and more people are just like, well, let's just use CGI and stand in a big void.
Use the vault, or like use stagecraft, and like, what can we do to address that? And it's when you go that way backwards, I feel like that's, you do lose a little.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel, I mean, we saw that with Obi-Wan and other things too, but I've noticed it quite a bit actually, even though I'm really enjoying Percy Jackson and the Olympians and obviously having a volume type setup is very helpful. Like when you have kid actors and need to do night shots that they couldn't otherwise do. But just a couple episodes, and maybe it's just the screeners, but it's not. But it's just very apparent that some sets are like so good. And then I'm like, oh, that is very obviously an LED screen or a screen, and it's not great.
Weirdly, both topics you and I have talked about on the podcast before, but I watch Obi-Wan or something like that, and you can tell it's the volume and it feels not real. And then we watch Strange New Worlds, and I know because I've seen behind the scenes thing that is an LED screen, a big, huge thing. And yet that doesn't detract from me.
I wonder
if it's because the set in front of it is so, like they've actually taken the time to like match the set to what, you know, like it just looks like a real place, even though behind them is clearly not, you know, like the warp core. Yeah. It's usually that, or, when they went to the snow planet, I forget. That was in the first season when they first meet DeGorn and stuff. Like, or no, it's in the second season. Who cares? It doesn't matter. But I also wonder too if it's because that's not a 360 thing. That is I think that's just a 180 thing, pretty sure. So they only need to project what the camera is gonna see. They don't need to do the whole thing. And I wonder if that is like they can take the time to make every individual shot look perfect and look as realistic and full of depth as possible. Whereas if it's a full 360, you kind of run the risk of flattening it out a little bit.
Yeah. I think that definitely could, because you're right. I don't think about it when I watch Strange New Worlds, even though, and I didn't know until I saw a behind the scenes. I'm like, oh, of course, sure. But I'm like, it doesn't jump out at me. Like, I don't feel. Yeah. So I do, you know, and that's kind of like talking about how like you watch documentaries about like what is up there with ILM, and the documentary Light and Magic that's on Disney Plus about ILM and its beginnings. And there's like a nostalgia, I feel like, and I know that practical things are still made on sets. Like, I'm aware and I appreciate that, but it is a different, it is not, I don't think, to the degree that it was then or on the Lord of the Rings films. And not always. I think, you know, there are always filmmakers who are like, we're going to do this. But that is not the standard. I think the standard is more like the volume and screens, which, look, you got to do what you got to do to tell your story.
Yeah,
but
of course.
More bigotures. What I'm saying.
Yeah. You hear weird stories like when they were filming The Rise of Skywalker, they used a 360 degree screen, but they had to go to the actual Jordanian desert because there's no other way to get that level of sunlight. And it's like, why did you do that? Just shoot the desert. You're in the desert.
You're there. Sky, desert, all there.
It truly makes no sense to me at all that they would do that. And yet that's what they have done. And I don't. not to just crap on Star Wars. That's not what I'm here to do, but they are the ones who use it most prolifically and most, in most settings. But you remember in The Mandalorian, I believe it's the second season is the one where Boba Fett shows up, right?
Yes. Yes.
The episode that Robert Rodriguez directed where Boba Fett gets his groove back, aka his armor back. That yes. one was actually shot outside and it looks so yeah, weird compared tell. To the rest of them.
It's yeah, because like, I was like, oh, they're in location, like in the desert? Like, because I just yeah. told like someone who was like, what if they could shoot at Galaxy's Edge someday? And I'm like, well, they don't go in location, so it's not even a discussion. And then shortly right. thereafter, I'm like, oh, they went, huh, why did they do that?
I know. It's, it, in a weird way, it like took me out of the show more than if they'd right. have just kept shooting everything on the volume. Because it's like,
me too.
Well, now I know that's like, a location. And
right,
like,
and then I'm like, where is that?
Yeah, right. And I was like, is that in Griffith Park? Like, where is this? Like,
well, at first I was like, is this Vasquez Rock? I'm like, no, it's not Vasquez Rocks. But
yeah.
Anyway, some friends yeah, I had this same yeah. reaction.
And like, we never have that issue with, first of all, we don't like, not nobody has ever been to New Zealand, but like when those movies came out, New Zealand was a place that not many people had gone to visit or whatever. The majority of people watching the movies will not have gone to New Zealand there. That's the most political way to say that. And so it can just look like a fantasy place. Like it just, right. that's, you know, it's not like we live in, or you have lived in LA. I currently still live in LA. And like, when I see place, I'm like, that's not that. Like my mom was watching like Castle or something like that on a rerun. When I was home one time and I was like, where's this show take place? And she's like, New York. And I'm like, do you want to know how I know that this is LA and not New York? And she goes, well, how? And I was like, cause you can see the sun.
Because
in New York, you can't see the sun from the ground level when you're in Manhattan for the most part.
Mine is like anytime there's a beach and it's never supposed to be Zuma Beach or Malibu Beach, but that's, I'm like, hey, look, there is Zuma. Like,
yeah, right.
That's where they are.
But like they just went and found like a hill in front of mountains because there's everything great.
No shortage of those.
Yeah. And they were like, let's build the Edoras, you know, thing there. That's, and it's real. Like it looks real, like it, because it is. And they literally just had a shot from a helicopter circle it. And it's like, hey, we built this whole city and stuff like that. I obviously know you can't do that with every production.
No, of course not.
But I think that's why. Yeah. Every other one should. but I think it's a detriment. Like that level of craftspersonship. It's another thing I need to fix saying, but needs to come back, or like it needs to be valued again. And I think that like we film dorks can talk all day long about how we like miniatures and model shots over CGI. Not that people who do CGI aren't craftspeople as well, but I don't want to see something like Quantumania where people are, you can hardly even tell that they're people because they're just like, it's just like weird
placed
cartoon characters. Yeah.
Yeah. I want a tangible,
fake. Just feels fake.
I mean, that we can, so many people, including me, can be like, I really want to go to Hobbiton because they built mm-hmm. it and then this zhuzhed up and that exists as a place. Like,
yep.
I like having that tangible quality and it's, you know, it's apparent when it's like, I want something that is like, I feel like I can, that's part of it, right? Like I can picture myself in this space, this mm-hmm. tangible space. I cannot really picture myself in the pixels of the quantum realm.
No.
For many reasons. That's a terrible yeah. analogy. But
yeah, I mean, it doesn't even need to be a fantasy setting. Like, you know, like the Mission Impossible movies go to real locations. And like, you can go, oh, I want to go to Paris because I watched Mission Impossible Fallout or whatever. And you're like, or that's something that the James Bond movies used to do a lot too, where they would be like, there would be set pieces in specific real cities so that it looks exotic and cool and you get added production value just from going to a place. And,
yeah. The Last Jedi, like so many beautiful places in Ireland, mm. like mm-hmm. Ahch-To is this like, you know, heritage site that they went to and like, so in Star Wars, like you can go to places. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It really brings something special. And then it brings like the fandom side of that, right? When you're like, oh, like I can go here and experience this and,
yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're lamenting the way it is now. But that is something that, like, for all the good and cool things that the Lord of the Rings movies gave to filmmaking, performance capture being number one, it also, like, even by the time they were making the Hobbit movies, it's like they were relying too much on let's just have, you know, the dumbest thing in the Lord of the Return of the King is, and it's funny and it, you might think it's cool or whatever, but the thing that looks the dumbest is Legolas running up the elephant and like killing all the guys and like putting it, it looks fake and dumb.
Yes.
Even in a moment when like ghosts have come from a ship and they're like swarming,
right?
It's still the Legolas. Cool. Yeah. And then you get to the Hobbit and it's like, you know, one of the Hobbit, is it Bomber? I think like with the barrel around him, like spinning around, like with knives or like, and bouncing through the, you know, the stream. And then of course, Legolas again, running up a crumbling,
like ridiculous. Yeah.
Like just breaking all the laws of physics. And it's just like, this looks so stupid.
So and silly.
How far we have fallen at that point. They had fallen, again,
but not it's Legolas. So, it's, no. He never falls.
No, he can't.
Yeah.
He's got hollow bones like a bird. Yeah, what are we talking about? Return of the King.
Return of the King.
I don't actually, you know what? I will say, like, I think it's kind of the actual moment when Frodo chucks the ring, or, you know, the ring goes into the thing, the Mount Doom. I think it's kind of an anticlimax, I have to say.
I was like, just thinking that, like, all the things I'm like, yeah, like Army of the Dead, right? Like the lighting of the fire, like the things. And I'm like, yeah, and he destroys the ring. Mm-hmm. Good job.
And it's tough because, like, by that point, we have spent so much more time watching the other Fellowship members fight and die and, you know, go through struggles and everything like that, and these big, huge, enormous pitched battles and everything. And then it's literally just these two hobbits and a weird former hobbit guy in a mountain. Like, it's just, I don't know, it just, there's a weird disconnect. And then you have, you know, the moment where Sam's like, I can't carry the ring for you, but I can carry you. Like, that's, it's nice.
Yes.
It's a very triumphant moment. But the actual, and I never buy for a second that Frodo's gonna like keep the ring. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like that's delaying the inevitable at that point.
I do love I'm glad to be here with you, like at the end of all things, like mm-hmm. that bit always gets me, but it's just not an emotional, but it's not like mm-hmm. to you. I'm like, okay, like, like Gollum, of course that was going to happen. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He can't let it go.
And then, that look of glee though on his face when he gets it and falls in, like that sticks with me.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
But
man, those movies, I mean, we're really nitpicking if we're having like, that isn't as exciting or as impactful as it should be. Like, it's still amazing.
Yes. Yeah, they're and like, all.
And it's worth it for when Frodo wakes up in Rivendell and all the different members of the Fellowship come in one by one. And like, they're all excited and happy and laughing and stuff. And then Sam's just in the doorway and he just like exchanges like a quiet look with Frodo. Like, we did it.
We've been through some shit, man.
Yeah. It's great. What more can we say? These movies are amazing. Do you have a favorite sword in the movie?
Hmm.
Or piece of, I guess, equipment or armament or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good one. And Narsil's got to be it, right?
It's a great design. It's very sleek and like, it's not like overly fancy or anything like that, but like, it's rad.
It's very like, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to go with that one. About you?
I can't remember the name of it right now. But Gandalf's sword, I always really liked.
Oh, is this Glamdring?
Glamdring. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's also too. It's like, it's not super fancy.
No, like, I appreciate it's got that like, much. The, like the curved cool hilt, which I always really like.
gosh, remember that was a whole thing and still is a thing. Like Noble Collection had like replicas of all the weaponry.
Oh my God. And there was the little like pamphlet in the DVD. And that was like, I would go through that.
Oh, that's right.
I would look at that thing so many times. I never bought any of those replicas though. I mean, obviously swords, those are huge, but like, I never bought like a replica One Ring or anything like that, which is or actually any memorabilia, like other than the books and the actual physical media. I don't think I ever bought like a toy or anything like that. Weird because I'm action figure Jones over here.
Yeah.
Never once bought an action figure from them.
I think same. I know I looked at them a lot, like especially with like they made replicas of like Ninja and the other Rings of Power. And I'm like, oh, these are pretty. But yeah, I just remember looking at the pages and like, oh, Arwen's sword is like really gorgeous.
It's cool.
With that, I'm like, really what am I going to do with it? And Weta has since, in your sense, I know that a thing I've been like tempted, like I just don't have a place for them. They have like Shire homes, right? Like that are kind of like miniature sculptures. And I think by now there are more than ones so you can like make like a Christmas village, but Hobbiton. But I've never bought them. I'm so much. I'm like, do I really not have any like merch?
I know.
And I like my books, I made
the
a
Lego
Hobbit terrarium.
Sets too are amazing. Like, I never bought one of those. I don't know. That's so strange. Like, of all the things that I like, you'd think I would get memorabilia or some sort of merch, and I have zero. I had zero.
I think I've had Bag End once, but I gave it away during one of my mini moves.
The Lego set Bag End.
Yeah. And now I'm like, why did I give that away? I shouldn't have done that.
I do that so frequently where I'm just like, why did I do that? In my moment of, I don't need this. Like people do things when they're drunk. Like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I do things when I'm like feeling very Marie Kondo. And then like, I definitely regret that stuff later. And
you're like, yeah. Like, oh.
Why did I get rid of it? It sparked joy.
Yes. I'm like, and now it's sparking sadness because I don't have it anymore.
I don't have it. And then I re-get stuff. Sometimes, most of the time, no, but
sometimes
I'll like, yeah, I'll be like, oh, I should have kept that. And then you got to try to find it. And it's usually more expensive. It's stupid.
Oh, can I tell you quickly my most, I'm still so mad at myself about this. Look, I've moved across the country, I don't know, four times now, five times, a lot. So, and I have a lot of books. So every time I move, I pare down. And I had, probably the first 10 books of Wheel of Time, like the hardcovers, they were like a weird book club size. They were like first edition. It was like a re-release. And I took them over the years to signings by Robert Jordan before he passed. And I had like 10 or so signed. And at some point I gave those away. And not only am I mad about giving away the signed copies of the Wheel of Time, they also still had the original beautiful cover art. By this artist named Daryl Sweet, and like re-releases paperbacks just don't have these like illustrations. And I'm like, I kick myself over it like approximately three times a year when I look at them. I'm like, oh, why, Amy? Anyways, I have not tried to reacquire those because I don't know how much they would cost, but
yeah, that's, we just, you know, we do these things. I sold when I was a very poor person when I first moved here and was living off credit cards. At a certain point, I had to sell the bulk of my DVD collection.
Ugh.
And so I think I've purchased the Lord of the Rings trilogy four different times, like, because I keep, they're always worth something when you sell it. So it's like, all right, I need this money more than I need these DVDs right now. But
New Line appreciates your business.
I know. I'm sure they do. Well, now I just got a 4K player. Finally, I'm like one of the last film dudes in the world to get a 4K player. So I'm like, as we were talking,
I'm so surprised.
How much is the Lord of the Rings trilogy on 4K? It's $75. That's a lot. Everything on 4K is so expensive because it's new.
I was gonna say, yeah,
it's worth it though. It does look really good.
I'm sure it'll look amazing.
Say, you know, not, I can't say it yet. I've only watched a couple discs, but I'm like, is it so good that I needed to upgrade?
I say that it's not, and then my husband's like, but it is. And I'm like, okay. Like, it doesn't always do it for me. Like, bigger TVs have done it for me when I've been like, I don't want to get a bigger TV. And then we watch something, and I'm like, all right, I'm glad we got the bigger TV.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I do know that, like our eyes, and even in living rooms, like, there's no reason to get an 8K TV in a living room because like your eyes just can't tell the difference between 4 and 8 at that distance. So like if they ever get to the point where it's like, now you got to buy it in 8K, it's like, that's no, you don't need to do
no.
that. But, and then the jump from VHS to DVD was like monumental.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
The first thing I ever watched on DVD was The Matrix. That was the first one that my parents bought when they bought their DVD
nice.
Player. And it was just like, oh my God, this looks so good. And then the bump up from when I first got a Blu-ray player and the first thing I watched on it was Planet Earth, the BBC documentary on Blu-ray.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh. And that was like, oh, I see what this technology does. I've yet to have that moment with 4K. And I will say that I haven't watched, I've only been watching older movies on 4K.
Okay. So maybe that's, so you need a.
So like if I watch like The Batman or maybe like Blade Runner 2049, maybe I'll see it at that point. But at this point, I'm only watching stuff from like the 60s and 70s. So
just like you're not going to notice. Anyway. Yeah. Keep me posted.
Yeah, I will. I will. I'll keep you posted. But folks, if I find out that 4K is not worth it, I'm going to sue all of you who told me to get it. It's really worth getting. No, my Blu-rays were fine. Anyway, doesn't matter. Is there anything else you want to say about The Lord of the Rings? I mean, we didn't really talk about anything in particular, I guess. But.
Yeah, no. I'm just, that's how I am when I come in. I'm like, just vibes, Kyle.
Yeah. The Amy episodes are always vibes. Which is fine. There's no reason that it doesn't need to be vibes. I like a vibes okay. episode. It's early in the year. It's January.
Me too. I can't think of anything else.
All right. Well, favorite character?
Aragorn.
Least favorite character?
Oh, great question. Who is my least favorite character? Who is, no, I like him too. I was like Theoden's, Eowyn's brother?
Oh, Carl Urban.
Carl Urban, Aemir. But I like Aramir, thank you. But now I'm like, yeah, I like
really
him.
He's not really that much.
No, he's not. That's why I was kind of like, he's just kind of, gosh, Kyle, who is my least favorite? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know either. I can't really think of who my least favorite character would be.
Like that one guy who sneers at Gandalf in Hobbiton in the beginning.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. My favorite character is probably, how can you not like Aragorn? Like, he's great.
He really is.
Viggo is so good. Did you know he broke his toe when he kicked the thing?
What? No, I've never heard that before.
Has no one ever told you that? Quietly while you're trying to watch a movie?
Definitely. I'm not the person saying that.
I think that's so funny that that's a meme. Because, like, it is so... Like, when we all learned that fact... That is something that has just been burned into our head forever.
It's true.
It makes me laugh. I'm still trying to think, do I have a least favorite character? I don't know that I do.
Sometimes Samwise, honestly.
You know, yeah, he's very earnest, and sometimes that grates.
Sometimes, but not all the time.
Mr. Frodo. Nothing against Sean Astin.
I think no, of course not.
There's no character that, like, I don't know if you remember, but do you remember who my least favorite Game of Thrones character is?
No.
Dan and I have arguments about this because he thinks that that's the point and that he's a good character. But Euron Greyjoy can jump up his own ass. I hate that character so much. And there's no character like that in Lord of the Rings where I'm just like, dude, hate this guy.
Yeah, there really isn't.
Even the villains, like, I'm like.
Even Grima, like, kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus it's Brad Dourif, who's great
fantastic.
All the time. That's like the fact that you got Brad Dourif and Christopher Lee, like. Peter Jackson knows horror movies and he's like, this is who I need to get for this, for the bad guy roles.
It's delightful.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I like all the characters there. I think I said it.
You did. You said it. We did.
And I'll say it again if I have to. Amy, plug something, anything you want to plug.
I really don't have a plug. You know what? Just follow me on Instagram, Amy_geek. I post mostly about birds and cats these days, and I think it's nice. It brings me joy.
Yeah. It's very nice. All of your very serene outdoorsy pics of your backyard and stuff. I really like those. Follow me on Instagram if you want to at functional_nerd. It's a lot of cats. I don't even have birds. It's just cats and
cats.
Follow me on Letterboxd, please. And thank you, Kyle_Anderson. As I said last week, you can see my entire ranked list of every 2023 release I saw in 2023. As I was going, I was just like, boop, 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 boop. You can see that my favorite movie of the year was Across the Spider-Verse. And you can see that my least favorite movie of the year was a festival movie. But my least favorite wide release movie was Renfield, a movie I think is repugnant and terrible and bad. Anyway, thank you all very much for listening. Thanks, Amy, for being on the show as always. I'm Kyle Anderson. Join me again next week on Naser Focus. Ugh, my guest will be someone else. Goodbye.
Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.